Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. How did Christianity begin? Why did we of European descent inherit a non-European religion? Is our spirituality deformed and weakened by tying it to the thought patterns and traditions of the Middle East? What are the strong and weak points of our own religious nature? Why are all of these subjects of the greatest possible import for our understanding of ourselves and for our future almost entirely ignored in public discourse? No man is better qualified to increase our understanding of these questions than the late, great Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver, classicist, linguist, scholar, and one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. This week, we continue our excerpts from his insightful work on the Jewish question under the title The Jewish Plague. Part 8. I give you the words of Revelo P. Oliver. Religiosity. The current intensive promotion of occult hocus-pocus, which so generally afflicts the young who have been intellectually disinherited and sabotaged in the public boob hatcheries, seems to indicate that many people who have no religion, have an instinctive appetite for some substitute for it. A few highly intelligent members of our race, including some I have observed in the graduate schools, men as well as members of the religious sects, who are, of course, too intelligent to practice witchcraft or drug themselves with mescaline or lysergic acid to get in touch with the infinite, want to believe in metempsychosis, an old Aryan faith at least, and in some cosmic intelligence, roughly comparable to the Hindu Brahma, that governs the universe in conformity with some higher purpose. A certain religiosity, a desire or need to believe in magic and miracles, which, of course, imply the existence of a preterhuman power capable of producing them, may be biologically innate in all races, and perhaps even in some species of mammals that are not anthropoid. That, at least, is an hypothesis that I have often considered. Many readers probably know Eugene Moraes's major work, The Soul of the Ape, but may not have seen his earlier and much shorter work, which was translated and published shortly after his death, under the title My Friends, the Baboons. In it, Moraes reports that when he and his assistant were observing a colony of baboons, and had succeeded in establishing friendly relations with them, they were awakened one night by an unprecedented visit from the dominant males, who were the oligarchs of the baboon troop. They finally understood that they were being invited to visit the lair of the troop, and following those leaders, they were conducted to the troop's sleeping place, where they found a number of females mourning over offspring that had apparently died of some epidemic disease. So far as Moraes could determine, he had been invited in the hope that he could and would resurrect the dead baboon children and restore them to life. There was sadness and howling when he departed, without having performed the desired miracle. Anatole France has written a very plausible essay on dogs, who regard men as their gods, with a piety which, France hints, does not essentially differ from the religious piety of human beings, except that the dogs can see and touch their deities, and so know that they exist, whereas human beings have to content themselves with figments of their imaginations. We must consider the possibility that our race, though distinguished, of course, for its unique ability for scientific research, may also have a particular and possibly related tendency toward, or desire for, religious belief. This makes us vulnerable to numerous hoaxes and impostures, particularly the kinds typically, perhaps instinctively, created by Jews. There is, I think, a great deal of truth in Spengler's identification and description of the Faustian soul of our civilization, with its yearning for the infinite as its idée maîtresse. Infinity can be temporal as well as spatial, and it is easy to see that this tendency of the racial mentality would naturally produce a very strong and intense desire for immortality. As Nietzsche said in his Midnight Hymn, "But in all our joys we desire eternity, deep, deep, deep eternity." Christianity. In the preceding pages, I have avoided specific consideration of Christianity, although, as far as I can judge from experience with my own writings, about 15% of the Christians are alert enough to see my implications. I think I have a greater sympathy for Christianity than my readers imagine, for I not only recognize it as a belief that was for a long time part of our civilization and produced such splendid monuments as the great cathedrals, but I also regard it as having been a consolation and boon to the great majority of our own people, and one that I am sorry so many must now do without. This is something quite different from the social utility of supernatural sanctions that may be the indispensable basis of a generally accepted and observed morality. My feeling for Christianity is, I think, expressed by what I consider one of the best poems of Sir William Watson, The Churchyard. I wandered far in the wold, and after the heat and glare, I came at eve to a churchyard old. The yew trees seemed at prayer, and around me was dust in dust, and the fleeting light and repose, and the infinite pathos of human trust in a God whom no man knows. It is that infinite pathos that touches me deeply. Before we consider Christianity vis-à-vis the Jewish survival strategy, let me first make two generalizations. One, the power and value of a religion has nothing to do with the personality or probity of its founder. The best example of that is provided by the Mormons, who are today the most solid and stable cult in the United States, and who successfully resisted longer than any other large church the contagious decay that quickly reduced all others, with the exception of some small, scattered, and discordant fundamentalist churches and some pockets of traditionalist Catholics, to the contemptible quackery of a social gospel and hypocritical irrationality. This really astonishing and massive religious edifice was founded by one Joseph Smith, a petty swindler who began his career by fleecing suckers by means of a magic stone through which he could see treasure buried in the earth. But after he was arrested and got off with a promise not to do it again, turned to the safer and much more lucrative racket of swindling suckers with religion. He founded a great church, but there is reason to believe that he didn't give a damn what happened to it after he was dead, and probably didn't expect it to last. Smith, of course, was a man about whom we have a great deal of information, both about his life and about his doctrines, whereas we know nothing whatsoever about Jesus, except the myths associated with his name. And these are so various, contradictory, and late, that he is, for all practical purposes, a mythical figure, like Adonis or Mithra. Even if there was a man by that name, as is likely, about whom the myths were assembled. If it were possible to ascertain who he was and what he did, it would not in the least matter if he were found to be a character no more admirable than Joseph Smith. 2. The Jesus cults that existed in the Roman Empire are connected with Western Christianity only in that some of them provided a pseudo-historical story that was accepted by the West. Our ancestors simply ignored the parts that our minds found distasteful, and a confused metaphysical doctrine expressed in words that our people misunderstood and progressively reinterpreted until the original meaning was completely forgotten. This is true not only of the rank jungle of Jesus cults that flourished in the second century and thereafter, but also of the Orthodox Christianity which came into being under the successors of Constantine. As Spengler points out in the second volume of the Untergang, even the Orthodox Christianity of the last days of the Roman Empire was still essentially a Magian cult, and as such was unintelligible to the Faustian mind. And he observes that Augustine, though revered by the Western Church, would have regarded the Christianity of Anselm, or St. Thomas, or Luther, as an abominable and incomprehensible heresy. And so would the other supposed fathers of the Church. They were fathers historically, of course, but had they known the Christianity of medieval Europe, they would indignantly have repudiated it as a bastard with whom they had no connection. There was no such thing as an Orthodox Christianity before the last two decades of the 4th century, when one bunch of holy men got hold of Theodosius by explaining to him how advantageous it would be for him to cooperate with them, and so were able to use the police power of the state to repress and kill their competitors, the Arians. A-R-I-A-N, Arian, is not to be confused with A-R-Y-A-N, the racial and linguistic term. The Arians, who had been the officially sanctioned brand of Christians, and so Orthodox, before that time. The Arians, now called heretics retrospectively, were guilty of being sufficiently logical to claim that a father was necessarily older than his son, and they naturally regarded as very stupid heretics the mystery mongers who claimed that a father and his son had been born at the same time. The latter, however, were clever enough to back Theodosius before he pushed his way to the throne, and to back Gratian against his father. And once they got their hands on the imperial power, they were clever enough to prevent potential competitors from muscling them out. The neat trick that holy men use today is to describe as heretics the innumerable Christian sects that did not have doctrines that can be conveniently twisted into conformity with what became orthodox by decree of Theodosius in 381, thus leading the unwary layman to suppose that there was an orthodox Christianity before that time. They also conceal the fact that if the brand that got power in 381 is orthodoxy, then all Western Christianity is a heresy, and they themselves are, by that definition, heretics. The only honest thing to do is to apply the term Christian to all the sects that claimed to be followers of a Jesus entitled Christus, who was really or supposedly executed in Judea in the time of Tiberius or thereabouts. When Christians become conspicuous late in the second century, most of them were Jews, and it is probable that the numerous letters of Paul, including both those that were incorporated in the New Testament anthology when it was put together, and those that were excluded for some reason, were manufactured at this time by Jews who wanted to take in Goyim on easy terms. This was a principal difference among the numerous Christian sects. The Nazarenes, whose holy book was a Gospel according to the Hebrews, of which fragments survive, and who spoke only Aramaic in their rites, held that only Jews by race could be Christians, since Christ, when he returned to butcher the hated Goyim, naturally wanted only Jews to rule the world. A compromise was made by the Ebionites, who had, among other things, a Gospel of Matthew, and who preached a perfect communism, with all property and women to belong to everyone in common. They held that Goyim, if they were circumcised and went through ceremonies to purge them of their native vileness, could become Christians second class. You've been listening to The Jewish Plague, Part 8, written by Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver and presented by your host, Kevin Alfred Strom. To read more of Dr. Oliver's works, visit nationalvanguard.org/Oliver. That's nationalvanguard, all one word, .org/Oliver. We'll continue this important discussion of the Jewish question by classicist, scholar, and teacher, Dr. Revelo P. Oliver, next week on American Dissident Voices.